an office turban. They said, is this man a Jew? Cause they're working for the clampdown. They put up a poster saying, we're more than you and we're working for the clampdown. We will teach our twisted speech to the young believers. Train our blue-eyed men to be young believers. Judging 5 to 10, I said, double that again. I'm not working for the clampdown.
Welcome to Live Culture. This month's show features a discussion with artist Gregory Cholet and curator Olga Kopinkina about socially engaged art practices. We opened with an excerpt from the Indigo Girls doing their take on the Clash's clampdown. The opinions represented on today's program are the opinions of Live Culture and its guests, not the opinions of WPKN or WPKN.org. I'm here in your apartment with
119 Payson Avenue.
Okay, I'm probably going to edit that out. But I'm with Gregory Cholet and Olga Kopinkina, and I feel like I'm in the right place. I feel like I'm in a place with two experts who are going to help figure out what to do in terms of adding a protest into your creative practice, ways of making art that involve protest. And Olga, you're primarily a curator, and you just finished a show on new feminism.
Yeah, my exhibition was exactly about what you just said, what to do.
Yes.
It's about, I showed the works of female artists from different countries, from different contexts and semispheres,
mm-hmm.
which who are trying to do some kind of talking about possibility of the direct action,
mm-hmm.
performances, mm-hmm. which are spontaneous reaction to the political events
in their countries, in their
yeah.
space itself, so out in the street.
Yeah. Street actions or some actions in the gallery,
mm-hmm.
but was in response to the political events that were happening.
And the show that we're talking about was called Feminism as Politics! Exclamation point.
No. Feminism is politics.
Is politics. Oh. One of your websites has it misspelled.
No.
The reviewer
misspelled it. Okay. Yeah. All right. Yeah. Feminism is politics! Exclamation point. And it was mm-hmm. at the Pratt Manhattan Gallery. Mm-hmm. And it really had a pretty international roster of people. What countries were they from?
It's from Russia, Ukraine, Guatemala, Argentina,
mm-hmm.
and also Western European countries like Sweden, and artists from Berlin who are Swiss and Austrian, mm-hmm. but they live in Berlin. And there is also a queer aspect of
mm-hmm.
this show that maybe not particular about, it's not related to what we're talking about, but it's more theoretical.
Mm-hmm.
But it's also political. I mean, theoretical doesn't mean that it's not political. So
right.
we also have to keep it together, practice and theory, and queer theories actually politicizes
mm-hmm.
feminism on this stage of development of feminism a lot. So that's why I thought that I will include it. I don't know how it relates to Trump, to the conversation about Trump. And
feminism? Well, women are most decidedly under attack. Women's bodies are under attack.
Yeah.
The whole pussy-grabbing statement.
Yeah.
Even just the way that women look, the way that women are objectified is a huge issue in this election. Well, I'd be interested to know what you think in terms of younger women voters. Do you think that they see themselves as feminists? Were the artists in your exhibit middle-aged and older, or were they younger?
Could I tack a question on to it? Like,
yeah.
Why did you call it Feminism is Politics? That seems to me very important to them.
Well, it's dealing with the concept new feminism.
Mm-hmm.
So that new feminism, which is formulated by a bunch of researchers and historians of feminism and theoreticians, means that feminism explores the condition of late capitalism, conditions of labor,
mm-hmm.
and condition of precarity,
mm-hmm.
you know, precariousness. And because women exactly are those who embody this condition. So, and it's not just about representation of body and, you know, of
mm-hmm.
course the body.
Right. No, but this
important.
Seems very relevant to
yeah.
Trump and the election and the aftermath of it
yeah.
then, if we were to see it that
yeah,
way.
But it's an attempt to take it beyond the just issue of body mm-hmm. and talk about labor, talk about unemployment, talk about immigration, mm-hmm. war and violence in the broader, you know, context.
And do you think that because of the election now that we've taken enough of a step backwards that we're going to have to go back to old feminism and the body?
I don't think we can go back, but I think that it's women, because it has been so much about the body, right? Mm-hmm. Like the issue of body and what happens to the body and how we define the body, gender body, right? Mm-hmm. Female body. This is something that this is the point that intersects with other mm-hmm. things, like, because immigration is also about body.
Sure.
Right? So the labor is also about body.
It most certainly is.
Yeah. And other things that, like war, violence, mm-hmm. it's also about body. So it's about this global and precariousness that mm-hmm. now everybody is experiencing. It's not that I want to completely wipe out the concern that women have.
Right. Know, well, and I don't think you can anyway, because work. I mean, I would like to forget about the body sometimes too, but as a woman, you can't.
Exactly.
It's constantly being flashed back at you, so there is no way to get...
Yeah, this is why it's very important to talk about these issues from mm-hmm. the feminist position, from the female position, because this women, like nobody else can...
But at the same time, your exhibition, in a way, questions the construction of feminism, obviously, because you include this queer theory mm-hmm. aspect mm-hmm. to it, right? That's important, and that maybe is what makes this moment a little bit different than the traditional feminism, I think.
Yeah. I started talking about the queer scene is because they try to eliminate or kind of blur this binary
right.
oppositions, men versus women, and right. to direct the critique towards the power structure, right, which is, of course, patriarchal, paternalistic, and that they embodied, most of the time they're embodied by male. And now in this relation, in these elections, we see how Trump rise to the power and how many women actually voted for him.
Was that a surprise to you?
Yes, actually, I was surprised.
I was very surprised by that.
Yeah.
I feel very naive, though, at this moment.
Yeah, a lot of surprise.
Yeah. I feel like there's a lot of things I misunderstood. And then
my whole family lives outside Philadelphia in Pennsylvania. Mm-hmm. Not really in the part that really was heavily Trump, but enough of a sense of what that was about. Mm-hmm. That it wasn't just about men. Yeah,
it's a bit... I was surprised because I didn't really... I didn't expect that women would do that, but... Mm. But I mean, what do I know? I think it has something to do with America.
Don't forget, most people didn't vote. So
here's another thing.
Constantly remind ourselves that fact.
So let's go back to the topic of protest and tie that into it, because Gregory, you've spent your life working on, or your artistic life.
Okay, it's fair.
Is that
enough.
Somebody's smoke alarm?
It's not here. Oh. It's not in our
We'll just tumble down. Yeah. But you've spent your career working pretty much on the subject of protest or
I was
critique.
Thinking how to sort of begin what seems like a tangle of many issues. But
right.
one thing that I thought of was an odd place to start was a lot of people in sort of the, you know, fringe, sort of fairly fringe, although as it turns out, Hillary Clinton herself might be part of it, the sort of fringe UFO community.
Right.
Believed that Obama was going to sort of disclose this thing called the disclosure that, you know, America has been aware of extraterrestrials, blah, blah, blah. For a
while. Oh, yes.
And I think what I'm thinking is that, in a way, we now have a disclosure mm-hmm. of what has been operating underneath the surface of this country for
right.
a long time. And so, in a sense, the election of the president-elect, he who should not be named, is essentially... putting it out on the table.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's an important first thing to recognize.
Right, all of those angry people who I've noticed their presence online. You know, there's really ugly things that are said online on a regular basis.
Angry and ugly.
Right.
And it's not that necessarily all those people are angry, ugly people per se, but there's very bitter feelings
mm-hmm.
that the Democratic Party completely failed to address.
I think so, too.
And the traditional Republican Party completely failed to address.
Mm-hmm.
And the president-elect basically hacked the easier of the two, which he might have been mistaken. It could have been easier to go into the Democratic Party. But he hacked into the Republican Party and succeeded. The problem is... I think less his character, as disgusting as it has been, than the people he has now surrounded himself.
This is, yes, This is somewhat off topic, but what worries me is this cabinet of dedicated people who will, in fact, be the ones doing it. He's not going to be there. He's going to go
he
off
could
and
be
do
moved
He
off.
Never was going to be
he
there.
He could be thrown in jail, you know, for being...
Or
you know,
he'll just
he
go
could
off and
do something
things.
That they don't like, and they mm-hmm. could put him out of the picture.
Right.
Because they now have the machinery.
Right.
The,
no, he's put it in place.
And he, that was his bargain with the devil, you might say.
Mm-hmm. One of them. I think there were several.
Perhaps many.
Several.
So we're really in this position where it's not, if we keep focusing on him,
mm-hmm.
I think we'd be making a huge mistake.
Right.
But we do need to focus on the fact that what has been sort of underneath the sort of really, I would, let's say, the last 40 years in which ultra-free market deregulated capitalism took over, that has been chased out into the open.
Mm-hmm.
And it has taken down with it, our ideas about liberal democracy. And not just here, it's happened with the Brexit in the UK.
Oh, sure.
The Austrians are about to have a new vote, which
well, this is,
maybe
right.
will go to the right.
No, Polish there's a horrible
have, I mean,
ripple effect.
India,
France is going to vote for
Le
Pen, I think.
It's just a whole wave of retraction into a kind of nationalist mm-hmm. and xenophobic, I mean, you know. So we have, so, but now we see it. It's out on the table. That's the first thing to sort of recognize is that's a plus for us.
Mm-hmm.
Because we no longer have to be sort of shadow boxing something that we sort of think is there or we don't know where exactly it is. It's right there. It's in front of us, front and center.
And what do you think that, what would the point of a piece of protest at this point be? Would it, what change could it affect? Because I feel like it's very difficult to have conversations. I feel like at this point things are, we're so divided and nobody's really going to agree. Even within the Democrats, there's people posting things about how Bernie Sanders supporters should apologize to Hillary Clinton. There's other people angry about Jill Stein. So there's all of these different factions and fractures, and nobody seems to be able to talk to each other. So protesting and just saying you're really angry about something doesn't seem very effective, other than the
really
fact
works.
That we should all talk
well,
about how angry we are.
Let's not forget 2003, when the largest demonstrations in recorded history took place across the world leading up to the invasion of Iraq by the U.S. and its whatever didn't stop.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that was one of the turning points we're talking about when we realized that the exercise of free speech and democracy have been greatly curtailed in the present.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I think that we should go beyond the interests and concerns of Democratic Party
mm-hmm.
and we should mobilize not around whoever is seemingly in power now and among the Democrats like Bernie Sanders,
mm-hmm.
but we should mobilize around the issues.
Mobilize around the issues
yeah.
instead. Good
instead.
Idea.
Yeah, like
locally.
Locally and you know, translocally or
okay, translocally.
Translocally. So across, you know, we should go definitely. Like for example, people from New York City go to North Dakota now, you know,
mm-hmm.
to support the indigenous people who are fighting there.
Mm-hmm.
So
water protectors.
Protectors. And do you think it's important to go there in this day and age? You could protest
I mean,
in lots of different places too. One doesn't need to, because one of the things that I wanted to focus on for the show was sort of what artists listening to this could actually do themselves. And obviously, lots of people have very limited means. Some people have time constraints.
Well, looking, you know, going back to the negative side just for a second, because we're going to be able to do that a lot.
There's a lot of negative
but
side.
We could say that one of the other things that's happened, along with sort of dismantling the way democracy has operated in a kind of, you know, the masses are saying this, therefore we should do that. I mean, this election's a great example. Most people who did vote, which was a minority, didn't vote for Donald Trump, as
mm-hmm.
we know. I mean, it's sort of a madness, right? But we also find that we're so sped up and so busy being productive
yes.
all the time that we don't have the kind of time that people once had to stop, organize, think,
mm-hmm.
and act. And so that's a reality, too, that you bring up that we need to take into account. But that said, I think two things, both to Olga's point, I would say that actually I think we do need to rethink the question of an international response.
Yeah. Yeah.
Really do have to think back to the question, what is the kind of international subjectivity now that is not part of this kind of nationalist authoritarian
mm-hmm.
developing phenomena, which
mm-hmm.
is clearly reaching across the globe.
Mm-hmm.
And then coming back to this question of actually demonstrating, I do think having bodies in places
mm-hmm.
is important.
Yeah, mm-hmm.
that's,
I do
it's
too.
It's not the
showing
only
up.
Avenue,
right.
but it certainly is absolutely essential. And I think Occupy showed
right.
just how important that was. It used these new media and communications technology to
yes.
to get there and to kind of maintain itself to a degree, but its physical presence.
It's the numbers actually, of people that make the most difference, isn't it?
It could be the numbers, or it could be just the strategic placing of bodies in a certain location.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So with Gulf Labor Coalition that I've been part of,
right,
and with Gulf, the global ultra-luxury faction interventions,
okay,
in the Guggenheim here in New York or in Venice, at the Peggy Guggenheim Collection, it was like physically being there to create a change,
okay,
on two levels. One is you manifest something that then the media, if you can organize them, have to sort of take into account,
mm-hmm,
as does the institution. So for a moment on May 1st, 2015, it looked like we were going to be arrested and taken out of the
right,
Guggenheim.
Right.
But the museum said to itself, we're not going to arrest a bunch of artists inside a museum. So that strategy worked.
You were listening to WPKN 89.5 FM and WPKN.org. This is Live Culture with your host, Martha Ouellette Lewis. We resume our conversation with Gregory Cholette and Olga Kopenkina after this by Purple Haze.
Don't you know you're talking about a revolution? It sounds like a whisper. Don't you know they're talking about a revolution? It sounds like a whisper. While they're standing in the welfare lines, crying at the doorsteps of those armies of salvation, wasting time in the unemployment lines, sitting around waiting for a promotion. Don't you know they're talking about a revolution?
Second point, though, is all the people who witnessed this walking in and just saying, look, we have a message, we're going to stay here and give you this message. It gives, I think, the viewers a chance to break the regime of the everyday suppression that they go through.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the unfreedom in a way that they impose,
yeah,
on themselves, right?
Yeah.
And just for a moment, they go, oh, well, wait a minute, I could do that.
Right. I think that's very empowering, knowing, yeah, that you can do that. And even though people are really depressed right now, the worst thing is doing nothing. Nothing feels better than, yeah, actually doing something.
Or feeling sorry for ourselves.
Oh, well,
or sitting,
yeah,
around just talking about how bad it all is.
Yeah.
This, so, we got to get over that phase.
We definitely do. It's deeply unappealing and it's so unhelpful.
Yeah.
But I wanted, could you talk pretty specifically about what happened in Venice? Just,
yeah,
like about the mechanics, well, of the project and what it looked like and,
well, on
for
May,
viewers.
Okay, well, on May 1st, 2015, Global Ultra Luxury Faction, which is a sort of splinter group from the Gulf Labor Coalition, entered the Guggenheim here in New York City,
mm-hmm,
and decided to stay and occupy the museum.
And were they wearing anything in particular, or was it
we
marked
had,
who they were?
We had flyers that we dropped from up above that, mm-hmm, that sprinkled down, so lots of people could read,
mm-hmm,
talking about workers' rights, also talking about the rights of the security guards that museum outsources,
mm-hmm,
for way below minimum wage, and so on and so forth. We also had a huge banner that we opened at in the base of the atrium, which was torn up fairly quickly, but then we stayed and occupied the space. Olga was also present.
Mm-hmm.
A week later, we went to Venice for the opening of the biennial, and then we, with a local group called Sally Docks,
mm-hmm,
which is a kind of local squatter cultural organization, we got boats, we went around the Grand Canal, and we,
mm-hmm,
took over the landing dock of the Peggy Guggenheim Collection, not allowing anyone to land. And this was also the evening for the American Pavilion event. And so they were, you know, they
and
let us sit
there.
And
this was a surprise for everybody.
Of course. And for 4 hours, they you know, they let us go, and finally, after a little bit more intervention on our part, they decided to talk to us and promised that we could meet with the Board of Trustees after that to really discuss the issues around labor in Abu Dhabi, which is the focus of our group.
And the focus of the group has to do with the building of new museums in
one particular museum.
In
our case, even though there's a series of museums, and we focused on the Guggenheim because it's a museum that has contemporary art,
mm-hmm,
and we're contemporary artists, as opposed to, say, the Louvre, and also because most of us are in New York. But the Louvre is the only one that's opened officially. So.
And the other thing about the Guggenheim is...
Actually, it's not officially open. I'm sorry. Apparently, there's a delay by 1 year.
For the Louvre?
Yeah. So it may be Maria Le Pen will open the museum.
Charmed. That will be delightful for everyone.
Well, it would be totally appropriate for the people in Abu Dhabi, given the regime.
We live in interesting times.
We do. We live in very interesting times. The Chinese curse has come true. The Guggenheim is a good choice also because there's Guggenheims all over the world, and there was plans
they're trying.
For, or they're trying to make
they were just
all
voted down in Helsinki came very close for the
third time.
Okay. They were voted down, and I think that's the end of it finally. But it came very close to actually happening, and it's not going to happen.
But this is what you are saying, is exactly illustration that and proof that we have to mobilize around the issue. So that's the most effective strategy. Like responding to what you said, that of course it's always more satisfying when you do something than, you know, rather than you're just sitting and moan.
Right.
I would say that it's also, you know, it's not just doing something drives should drive people. It's just doing something particular that you know would be effective.
That's an issue that you personally care about.
Yeah.
Is helpful.
Well, personally, but also you know, there is such a thing like solidarity, and
mm-hmm.
you know, maybe this pipeline, you know, Dakota Access Pipeline, doesn't affect me personally, but I would still, you know, kind of sympathize with people who live there, and I care about that. But what I'm trying to say, that for example, my impulse when I learned about the elections, results of the elections, my first call was not just go and protest against Trump, because mm-hmm. I wanted to sit and think what was happening. So, and I didn't join the protesters, you know, the protest in the city against Trump and around Trump Tower, because I don't see that as effective.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't think how effective it is.
Well, and he did actually win the election.
Somebody
wins an election, go and it's one thing. It's another thing if you actually think that there's been tampering with the votes, but.
They didn't need to tamper the votes. There weren't enough votes.
Right.
That's the,
right.
You know, this is the problem, is that, and going back to what Olga was saying, is the Democratic Party is broken.
Mm-hmm.
And it's clear from the choices they've made since the election that they're not going to fix themselves.
Right.
They're just repeating the same thing with a little adjustment. And that's a real, really unfortunate. But that is a reality, too, that's now on the table.
Mm-hmm.
So we know what the, you know, we know what the ultra-right, largely evangelical type authoritarians that will be in office are about, and we also see where the so-called opposition party, which is not an opposition party, is not going to be proving itself to be much, and that's the reality. So where do we go from there? Who's
mm-hmm.
organizing what? How do we go about it? That is the key,
right?
And doing things where we can really sort of communicate with one another about what we're organizing and how we're organizing is important. So we started a little listserv, which I'm going to give you for your podcast.
Oh, fantastic! Okay,
and it's just a little. It's not even listserv
when
yet.
We,
I just have.
When you say we, are you talking about you and Olga, or
just send out an email to about 100 people.
Okay,
but it needs to go bigger than that. It was mm-hmm. just an initial start to say, okay, who's organizing what at this
right.
moment? So we
right.
got a little list going, and now we need to kind of move it. You know,
that's kind of what happened after the immediate depression for me too.
Yeah.
Was that all of I started communicating with other people? Other people started communicating with me, and we all started
exactly.
trying to figure out what to do now.
And we need to find a platform in which all of us can
mm-hmm.
put our heads together.
Right,
that's
a way of effectively communicating.
But I think
with
in the arts, I think it's important, and I very much support the Dakota Pipeline Water Preservers, Water Protectors, but I do think in the arts, we should be focusing also on our issues, because
mm-hmm.
our issues are no longer just, well, someone, you know, his work got a little censored, or, you know, someone did something at a museum. Now we're talking about integration with this global economy.
Yeah.
So the Abu Dhabi Museum was an example of that. I say was because it may not actually be built at this point. We're not sure. We're still waiting to hear. But it was clearly, and that whole zone, the cultural zone in Abu Dhabi with NYU and the Louvre, clearly is an example in which high culture, high education, academia are integrated into this kind of massive, sort of highly capitalized global, and now more and more authoritarian, labor-suppressing regime. We are artists participating in that. That's where we need to sort of begin our entry point. One of the entry points, I would say, is to begin to get that sorted out, clarified, and protested in a very rigorous way.
Yeah, and artists do, right? Like, I mean, the Occupy Wall Street was driven by artists mostly. So
in Zuccotti Park,
so many artists
That's
groups
right.
and artists, even like
sure.
Some interesting artist project generated from
right. And that's something that really interests me, because I already, as an artist, I don't have quite enough time to do my work, to make things. This is a big issue. And if you're going to be spending a lot of time protesting, which I imagine in the foreseeable future we will all be spending more time doing that, how do you find creative ways to make the two meld together, to make ideas and images merge into something that's a little bit more creative than just showing up and yelling? Or
That's a really good.
Waving a banner.
There was an essay which I can also provide you from a young woman in Tahrir Square, mm-hmm. an artist, who said, you know, we're abandoning our studios
right.
to work in this, and will we ever go back to them?
Right. And so how do you make that into art?
Yeah. And it's a question that keeps coming back, because going back to the 1960s, there were a lot of artists involved in 68. This is before my time, but I know these people from having worked with them, mm-hmm. some of whom abandoned making art or almost completely abandoned making art. And that was their calling. They felt they had to sort of move on and do something more directly political.
And did they see it as a kind of performance?
No. Kind of theories weren't, and okay. ideas were not even available at that right. time. Not accessible.
And Olga, you as a curator, of course, you're going to want objects or residue,
yeah.
remnants from protest,
yeah,
things. You need to have something, and it needs to be visually dynamic in some way, or else people aren't going to look at it.
That's the problem.
Yeah.
That creates a huge problem.
Yes. Yes. So
for
some
curators, I mean, not the problem, but the gap
yeah.
between the artists who are involved in activism and
mm-hmm.
This issue of representation.
Yeah.
And activism.
And we want it to be really good, really interesting art, really visually engaging art too, is the other thing. And I'm hoping that this will lead to sort of interesting and innovative approaches to what one can do.
But visualization is not just the artist or curator's prerogative. It's also, now we have Instagram,
mm-hmm.
right? So now everybody has taken snapshots and posted on the Instagram. So
yeah.
now this curating thing is actually, it's one of the social media functions,
mm-hmm.
right? My students,
I was going to ask you about how you felt social media actually fit in. Because
yeah.
showing up is one thing, being in the
yeah.
actual, but then there's all of this
dialogue. Because the protest and protesters, they are using their visualization techniques very,
mm-hmm.
very actively. So, and this is why.
Meaning what?
Visualizing themselves, doing.
Taking
selfies, taking pictures, also taking surveillance. You know,
mm-hmm.
this
mm-hmm.
Surveillance is going on not just on the side of the state and police, but
no,
also
that's right.
on the side of the citizens.
Sure.
Right? So that it's called. I was reading this theoretical work on social media. It's called synvalence. So synchronized surveillance.
Synchronized surveillance.
Yeah. So when we constantly, I mean, like, this is the dominant type of activity, right, in our time, which is dominated by the social media, that we
yeah.
constantly tag each other, report, register, you know.
The problem is that it just ends up, it seems to me, in this kind of stream of things that appear and disappear, as opposed to creating a kind of file or archive or history. So while people may pay attention to things that they hadn't noticed or knew were going on in the moment, it also
it's a question of use. I mean, it's going on. It's
mm-hmm.
going on not just during the protest. I mean, people do it all the time. Like tourists do it, right? So anybody
sure. no,
anybody does
do.
Any kind of collective events is documented. Immediately and post it, right?
Yes.
On some kind of cloud.
No, irritatingly, everything is
everywhere.
Documented right now, yes.
But I think it's another question for tactical media,
mm-hmm.
How they use it as a tool, right?
Mm-hmm.
How they use it as an instrument of the struggle. So, and we, I'm sure, and they are using it, right? So they are using it.
Yeah, I mean, in the one of the sort of strategies that came out of, let's say, the more of the 60s, 68, was in a sense coming away from Guy Debord's famous essay on the society, the spectacle,
mm-hmm.
or the sort of critique of the spectacle, the situation as presented, which would be to sort of consciously withdraw from the spectacle,
right.
or to interfere with the spectacle, but not to produce yet another spectacle.
Mm-hmm.
That, you know, and so we have to face that possibility that because everything in this new phase of capitalism is so aestheticized, and all of these sort of new technologies we're talking about are like almost kind of like reproducing some notion
mm-hmm.
of representation at many, many different levels, that perhaps one of the strategies has to be to just step back and not produce.
Which
not
is impossible.
Produce
no,
a spectacle at least.
Which is
but isn't it the same thing as silence?
not to withdraw into silence, but to do it in a way that's effective and affirmative, an affirmative negation, you might say.
One of the things that I have problems with, and I maybe I'm shallow and frivolous, but this sounds so unfun, and it feels like we're not going to have fun for a very long time anyway.
We're not going to have fun anyway.
I know. And for me, I keep thinking that there has to be a way that's sort of aggressive and yet still has a sense of humor and can do things in a way that allows me to make things that I want to make that involve
I think we need to examine
and color and things.
Right, I agree, but I think we need to really examine this phase of the last 40 years or so when tactical media, as Olga mentioned, and other interventionist strategies, which I've been very much part of, came into being alongside this kind of highly entrepreneurialized and very visual aestheticized capitalist phase of, you know, deregulated, neoliberal, whatever you want to call it, right?
Mm-hmm.
They are both in synchronization with each other. That's not to say that artists directly contributed to the problem, but they're entwined with the problem. Mm-hmm. And to not understand those contradictions is a really big mistake, to just kind of blindly go back into that mode.
You are listening to WPKN 89.5 FM and WPKN.org. This is Live Culture, and I'm your host, Martha Ouellette Lewis. The opinions represented on today's program are the opinions of Live Culture and its guests, not the opinions of WPKN or WPKN.org.
Zibidi bababo, je suis le roi de la danse. Oh, la jungle est à mes pieds. De la puissance, je suis au plus haut. Et pourtant, je dois vous envier. Je voudrais devenir un homme, ce serait merveilleux. Vivre pareil aux autres hommes, loin des singes ennuyeux. Oh, whoopie-doo, je veux marcher comme vous. Parler comme vous, faire comme vous. Comme moi, pourrais-je croire être parfois bien plus humain que vous?
Resume our conversation with Gregory Cholette and Olga Kopenkina.
I think this is when we need to really also have some critical theory, not to withdraw and step back and get away, but to use it in a tactical, tool-based way to address exactly these problems. Because we simply serve up another batch of eye candy that happens to be about negating what the conservatives are doing or criticizing them or feminists. I don't think we're going to do anything except accelerate exactly the problem we're in now.
Or polarize.
Or perhaps even further polarize. So we need to really begin to think again about these kind of questions. What is the function of visual culture and art? And what is our function as people who might be critical within that? Not just to do selfies, not just to archive everything, but how do we actually make an intervention? And it may require a negative affirmation of some sort, something that doesn't spectacularize what we're doing.
Except, I'm thinking about what you were saying about people visiting the Peggy Guggenheim Museum at Venice.
Yeah.
It was spectacular, first of all. It involved boats. I assume decorated boats. And
but we had plenty of flags and, you know,
flags.
Imagery.
Okay.
It was a spectacle.
It was a spectacle. And part of it was about addressing the public who were coming in.
Partly, but it was also to address the media.
Right.
Which were there for the biennial, so this was the perfect way to say, here's our message, and we can sort of compete a bit with the biennial.
But you enjoyed the fact that the public actually saw this and took a step back, and it gave them pause. I think in order to draw people in, you have to have some kind of honey. There has to be something
This is not a new conversation. I've been having this conversation since 1980.
Want to have something.
So it's clear, and it's worth kind of going and reviewing those conversations a little bit. But just along these lines, I got an email recently from a young woman who was an intern at Peggy Guggenheim Collection when these actions took place.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, she said, I'm actually going to write something for a magazine, I believe, in Canada, pointing out that, you know, we were treated so badly by the Guggenheim, and I wanted to sort of like talk to you about like why that happened.
The intern there was
And our actions gave her, in a sense, I think it gave her a sort of way to move into the mode of critique.
Mm-hmm.
So there are those interesting effects,
right?
That, you know, and maybe the spectacularization was important, but we shouldn't be too, we shouldn't get so caught up in our need for pleasure for that that we forget what we're trying to sort of drive at, the critique that we're going. It's important, I think you're right, to have a little sweetness. I mean, even Brecht said this.
There has to be something. Yeah. Waking up in a completely austere and
dissolved completely into the sweetness is, mm-hmm. would also be, I think, a huge mistake that we can't allow that to happen either.
Mm-hmm.
No, but the artists are doing this. I mean, artists can't avoid theatricalization,
no.
and performativity of this protest. I mean, it's the part of the Gulf Labor group protest in Venice was actually their precarious workers
pageant that we created, which
you made a parade,
which was a theatrical scene. I mean, this is not the issue. I think it's not like really the issue.
Yeah, and it's also worth pointing out that Gulf Labor was continuing to actually sit down at the table, just like the one we're sitting at now, with, you know, the people at the Guggenheim, and trying to actually show them and have ways to sort of like resolve the problem.
So you had sort of two arms.
Two
you
arms.
Had like a kind of
exactly.
A PR.
There was always even though we were in a boycott mode, we said we continued to meet and discuss and present them with actual options from human rights groups about how you could actually resolve this. Because wouldn't it be great if the Guggenheim were a model for fair labor practices?
Right. If they turned around and said we're not going to do this, we're
and
going to actually.
There we go. We have you know, a fantastic model for everyone in the art world to say, okay, this is a way
forward. They did it.
The issue is that then the institutions, the you know, art institutions, museums, and art centers, that they start embracing this tactics and this type of projects that artists are doing on the streets. They start embracing it, and they start like bringing it in, you know, and kind of. By doing this, they're enclosing the...
They eat it up.
Yeah.
As long as it doesn't fundamentally affect the underlying structure that they're dependent on, which are the huge corporations, this kind of international money, which is embedded with regimes that, you know... Well, the regimes are getting closer. That's the thing that's
so
really disturbing. It's not like we can just say they're over there in the Gulf. Now we feel them right nipping at our heels. But nevertheless, all this entwining with this situation, as long as that isn't affected, the museums will have social practice exhibitions and they'll have political exhibitions. They won't get down to that level. They won't let that happen.
So the choice for them, if they didn't do this, how would they fund themselves? I mean, we'd have to have government funding for it, no?
It goes back to the question, how do we go to Washington now protest if we don't have any means even to buy a ticket? Right. So that's the same. This sort of question, but I think that the answer is that we have to organize. We have to organize the alternative, create alternative spaces,
or
networks.
Take the alternatives that have developed, which are they're there in many different ways, and continue to draw the connections between.
Right. And I do think that even just really locally, if every, you know, wherever you are, you can meet in a group and sit down in the middle of the street, and if enough people do it in different places around the country, even if it's, you know, you don't necessarily need to be in Washington, D.C. to have an impact.
Or North Dakota, or in
the location of whatever the event is that you're talking about.
But I think we have to recognize just how much the systems that we counted on for demonstration, even the precarious part, workers' pageant we created, etc., these things, how much it's part of a failed democratic model at the moment. We're clearly seeing democracy collapse across most of the developed world. That's a really, really big problem that, and capitalism is failing. This is part of the reason why neoliberalism, which kind of saved this kind of already bankrupt capitalism from the 70s and 70s, you know, kind of bailed it out with this kind of entrepreneurship and, you know, ultra-free market, laissez-faire, that's failing.
Mm-hmm.
So we're entering a very, very difficult moment when nationalisms, authoritarianisms, forced labor, etc., huge surpluses of labor, roboticization, that's a huge part of what's going on now.
Right.
Yeah, sure.
Plus,
the president
there's
may,
so few jobs and people
exactly.
don't have, I mean...
The president may actually bring some of these, keep some of these companies in the country, but that doesn't mean the workers are going to get those jobs. They're going to become automated jobs.
Right.
I mean,
people more and more are going to be servicing machines.
And people will be servicing machines
if
they
have
skills.
Right.
Which many don't.
Well.
So we're really facing that kind of a, I think, a global catastrophe right now. And we need to think internationally and globally about it, not just locally. Locally is good. Don't give up the local, but don't just...
Well, in terms of individual artist empowerment, I feel like they have to start somewhere, and right. local is the somewhere.
But reaching out to people there's people all over now networked
right.
in Europe, in Asia, in Africa, in South America that you can connect to now mm-hmm. very easily who have the same exact concerns. So I think that's local too in a different kind of way.
How dangerous do you think these kinds of conversations across systems like Facebook and so forth are people putting themselves in danger by free speech is that issue? So
that's beyond like you I don't know that area well. I mean, obviously we can see with what happened to several individuals recently who data dumped and whatever.
Right.
You know, those things can happen, but there are ways of doing fairly discreet conversations. Gulf Labor was able to infiltrate into the United Arab Emirates, even though they were trying to stop people from getting there,
mm-hmm.
and they did stop physically several of our members from actually getting on planes.
Right.
Others went through, so you can. Yeah. You can do this.
And certain countries have firewalls around their internet. Yeah. So,
but not the countries we're talking about.
Yeah.
Argentina, Chile, Brazil, Sweden, Finland, and all kinds. Everywhere there's people working exactly on these issues. And as this accelerates, like we said, now that it's on the table, the opposition will become even more clear. I think it coalesces better. And finding ways to talk with each other that are secure, of course, is essential.
Well, but I see how so many people are living Facebook now.
Yes.
Yeah, I don't trust Facebook.
And it's not because of the issue
right. because
of exposure and danger mm-hmm. that can put you in danger, but also because the Facebook conversations proved so unproductive and inefficient. So, and I think that the people are just very
disappointed.
It's
an echo chamber.
It's an echo chamber, and it's like this kind of electronic noise.
Mm-hmm. It's a distraction.
Yeah, it's a distraction, and people are just sitting on the internet. I know particular people who just like sitting 24/7 on Facebook, and they make their name, but they don't really do anything particularly.
And I feel like that's going to be one of the challenges: getting people off of their phones, and out into the world.
Yeah.
And I might disagree with you. Because I actually do think that there has to be something sort of enticing to it. There has to be some other than just pure misery, which is also an enticement to move out into the streets too. But hopefully there's something about the joy of collectively being together and doing something.
I'm a full believer in Emma Goldman's. If I can't dance, you can keep your revolution. I do believe that is the right approach. I'm not trying to say that we should. Put on black garb and ashes and walk around beating ourselves to get people excited about protest. That's not the way to go. But I do think we need to think clearly through the fact that, as you're both saying, all of these forms of spectacularization is connected with the internet, connected with faith. They didn't lead us to a good place.
No, and they make you feel like you're doing something when you're not really doing something. So you're signing petitions and you're posting things. And I'm guilty of this. It's not... I do this too, but...
We are kind of accelerated. It's what in media language called accelerated reality.
Accelerated reality.
Because we have this media, and then we have to produce things in order to sustain the media.
Feed the beast.
Yeah, because we like to click and, and write the... It's very easy to sign the petition. So now there is a website that only generates this petition like 5 a day, or like 100 a day, I don't know.
And once you're on a list,
don't forget it.
And meanwhile, you're supporting the commercial interests that are actually advertising.
Yeah,
and gathering your data.
Exactly.
So,
I mean, this is where we need to sort of have a clear sense of how to use it without being abused by it.
Right, because there are a lot of distractions out there and ways of sort of getting you unfocused both from doing your own artwork and from really paying attention to what's going on. So, Olga, back to your exhibit, did you start these conversations conversations with, did you find your artists all over the world through the internet, or were you, is it because you were physically traveling? Was it through Facebook?
Both. It's part of my curatorial work.
Okay. Yeah.
So it's part of my profession. So I know artists for those things.
Yeah, but what do you do? Is what I'm saying, like, in a really nuts and bolts way? Do you travel to the country, or you're
I don't have to travel to the country to. Media and even Facebook is a very good professional tool. You know,
I've always thought it was very good in terms of the art world.
Of course, and let's not dismiss completely Facebook, because Facebook helped organize revolutions, like in Ukraine and Egypt.
Yeah,
you know,
there was Twitter too, I think.
Twitter, yeah. Which is really Facebook surprising. Twitter seems really surprising to me, that short messages.
And cell phones.
Right? Yeah, cell phones.
Yeah, and in Turkey, this protest in Gezi Park, because in Turkey, the Facebook, I did some research, the penetration is like 70%.
Yeah.
70% of population in Turkey.
In each of these cases, though, the let's say the art/interventionist tactical media hackers were a couple steps ahead of the authorities, let's put it that way.
Making sure
but
that
the authorities are now, like, they catch up pretty quick. So, you know, this is one of the games that's going on as well, is that they've now created ways of blocking Twitter or other things from really being effective in certain situations, or making it illegal.
But that's always going to happen.
Well, I'm just saying that we need to be aware that these systems are useful up to a point, but they also become themselves.
They become as obsolete
very quickly, and we need to kind of constantly be thinking to the next level.
See, that's the really exhausting part about technology anyway, is the way that it moves
but
so fast. And there is
the next level might actually be going back, as you were saying, just organizing in the street. You know, like having the most latest. It might mean, let's go back to a tactic that they did 25 years ago.
Right. You are listening to WPKN 89.5 FM and WPKN.org. We resume our conversation with Gregory Cholette and Olga Kopenkina.
Let's go back to a tactic that they did 25 years ago. Right. Living newspaper, which was, you know, back in the 30s, they were doing these projects in the U.S., but also in the Soviet Union, other places, where people would get up and enact the day's news.
What a fantastic idea. Okay. Did they wear costumes, or were they...
Sometimes they dressed up as, you know, they had props. You know, there was a huge occupation of the Trenton State House in the 1930s, I'm pretty sure. I have to check. Because the people were not getting paid their sort of welfare checks, unemployment checks, I believe, so it would have been after the Depression. And during this occupation, people were literally sleeping in the State House. They were enacting for performances of the Daily News, because in those days you didn't open your laptop.
Right.
People came in and they did performances of the news.
And where were they getting the news from? They were getting it from the newspapers? One person would read the newspaper, and then another one would turn it into...
So it was like the human mic in a way.
Right. Right, the human mic, which is that was quite lovely too. That had a singing element to it too.
Sure.
And I guess these are the things
but
that
these
I think
go back
that
to
artists are actually really good at.
Don't forget
at.
The town criers of the medieval period. They come in and they tell the news. It's a kind of rediscovery of some really basic
and storytelling and narratives. We're very gifted as a species at doing this. I think it's hardwired into us, passing the time by communicating other worlds and other times and other moments.
So I think rather than completely retreating from all of this, we need to sort of dive into it, but with eyes wide open.
So what's your plan?
My plan?
Yeah.
Read a lot of science fiction books. I'm working on an exhibition, I can show it to you, of drawings of you know, direct action protests. So that's one aspect of... Yeah, and I'm drawing. I'm making ink drawings.
So do you draw every day? I mean, I feel like
pretty
doing
much
some work every day makes me feel
when I'm not working on
better.
My book and my thesis. I'm trying to. Yeah.
And you're nodding, so you must have something similar. You're doing an exhibit at Franklin Street Works for the spring.
I'm co-curating this exhibition with my partner, Evgeny Fix. It's called The Work of Love, The Queer of Labor. So it's about queer and class, so intersection of queer and class.
And that will, do you know when that will be?
When?
Yeah.
In May.
Okay, May at Franklin Street Works.
Do you
so
have
people will just have to keep
my show
posted about that.
January 6th.
Okay.
Sure.
And
Station Independent Projects.
Station Independent Projects. Okay. It's a really nice gallery. It's a small space.
It's a wonderful
though.
Small space.
Yeah.
And it's called Darker.
Darker.
And it's really a little bit reference to Leonard Cohen, but also the moment, but also trying to sort of look at these very contradictions I was talking about.
Right.
Also through the lens of the Pergamon. Altarpiece is in Berlin, but it's about the struggle between the gods and the humans.
Oh, nice. And you have a book coming out, which is coming out after you finish your PhD, which you're almost done. Both of you are kind of exhausting.
Delirium
you do a lot of
and
things.
Resistance, activism. Start and the Crisis of Capitalism. It has a preface by Lucy R. Lepard, who I worked with many years ago on a group
She's
called
a wonderful
Political
writer.
Art Documentation Distribution in 1980, when Reagan was elected, and artists got together and started doing newspapers. Activist props for street art and created an archive, which is now in the MoMA. So there's a similar moment, probably early May is when it'll come out. Pluto Press and its University of Chicago distributes.
Wonderful, yeah. Wonderful.
So. And I teach at NYU and I'm working on my new syllabus for the course on gender and globalization.
So don't you think that there's going to be a lot more interest now? You're probably going to be flooded.
I haven't seen it yet.
No.
Because it's also this type of issue, like feminism and gender is not very, it's surprisingly not very popular among Western.
Yeah, but it might, I think, Martha has a point, I think it's going to become
I think it's going to blossom.
But
I do.
Perhaps yeah. I'm hoping. But right now I looked at my roster and I only saw like 16 people.
Just wait.
Students were very upset, NYU students, yeah. Because I came to the class after the elections.
Whether they voted or didn't
They voted.
You think they voted?
But they were extremely distraught and upset with the results.
I had the day off from school at Yale.
My students asked me not to do a class, but talk to them about the elections. So I also had to do that. So
that seems better than just not going to class at all. Being together and talking about it seems like a more reasonable way of dealing
because
with it.
Some teachers didn't show up. So they told me, my students told me that some teachers just didn't come in class, to the class, you know.
And I don't think sitting around and crying is a particularly,
and they were
a useful approach either. Yeah. I think many people had a moment of shock. I had a moment personally where I just wanted to crawl under my duvet for the next 4 years, have a belt of whiskey and then go hibernate. Right. And, you know, that went away. And now it's time to get your gloves out and...
Yeah.
Find ways to...
But I think if we don't want it to become 8 years or worse, God knows what could happen with the Constitution. I mean, Berlusconi was actually elected twice after he was elected the first time. Then we really need to sort of invigorate our organizational abilities and recognize that the Democratic Party is not going to get us through this. We need to have an alternative or a left side to the Democratic Party or something. That's going to have to be one of the missions at the parliamentary level. And the direct actions at the organizational level have to be done.
Yeah, it's this election's kind of wake-up call. And also for
the
young people...
Oh, it certainly is that.
for the young people who are, for the students from these progressive colleges who were just, sitting and crying because they thought that... Nothing like this would ever happen in their life because they had, many of them coming from this,
very soft environments.
Yeah.
Well, I'm hoping they're going to step up to the plate.
One of the first groups, though, we really need to sort of consider and take and sort of protect is the immigrant population.
Right.
Yeah.
In our school at Queens College and at CUNY and several of the colleges I know, they're trying to create a sanctuary school environment. I know Pratt's trying to do it, other schools, where these students would be protected from any kind of legal action. But that's very important because those seem to be the people that are going to be on the front lines of the initial force of this government.
How much about law do you personally both know? Do you have very good lawyers at all times when you're doing these projects?
One of my best friends lives upstairs and he's a legal aid lawyer and does immigrant issues. So if something like that came up, I could certainly...
A project in Venice or when you're
not at this time.
We're protected by the First Amendment, aren't we?
Yes. And there's nothing to worry about. Okay.
Yeah.
No, but do you in fact?
I'm trying to think if we ever really. When we did the intervention here in New York at the Guggenheim on May Day back 2015, we did actually sign waivers and we also had legal representation present just to talk about what happens if you get arrested. You don't need to know it as much as you need to know the people who know it who can give you the information.
Well,
you can get yourself.
Is there one website that you would recommend that has a clearinghouse?
At this
for
point
any
I
of
don't,
this?
But I will give you some links.
That would
so
be
by
great.
The time your piece comes out, hopefully they'll be exactly what you're looking for.
The day before the new year.
Yeah.
To think first of all about people of color and immigrants. That's the most vulnerable group.
Yeah.
So like, that would be the, so if we were making a hierarchy of things to worry about.
Right.
But also how our, how we contribute to this question of immigrant rights.
Right.
And, you know, the Black Lives Matter movement,
right,
protecting their sort of, because they've done a great job. They've got, I mean, not that we white people are going to come and protect them.
No, but everybody needs, sure, solidarity is really important. It's really important. Yeah. Divisiveness does need to stop.
But we know that the new regime is going to sort of be targeting those groups first.
Right.
And
right.
I think you're right. That's where we should start to focus,
okay,
our attention.
That's good to think about.
This is probably the most vulnerable groups. This is where we need to kind of build resources and solidarity. Maybe we can also show like a model of how to sort of continue to engage in protest and resistance by doing something really, you know, interesting and important, and perhaps even taking over some of the work that journalists can't do at this point.
Good idea. Yeah. Now we have some hopeful alternatives. Okay.
We'll make a list.
Okay, we'll make a list. Start. That sounds good.
Well, there are these websites and people who are fact-checking and whatever. I mean, mm-hmm, maybe taking those facts into the streets, you know, taking those facts, mm-hmm, into Trump Tower, beginning to sort of, like, get that information out there,
mm-hmm,
which also emphasizes that we believe in the possibility of fact-checking this government.
Right.
I mean, my hope, you know, if I have a hope, is that the Sanders movement people and the Black Lives Matter movement people can somehow find common ground, because that would be the most powerful instrument right now.
Well,
with immigrant rights people.
It seems to me we don't have a choice. We have to find common ground. I see things getting more and more splintered and factionalized, and it can't.
Let's hope.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Anyway, thank you both very much on that cheery note.
Yeah. Okay.
Thank you very much.
We had a few cheery notes.
Thank you for listening. This has been the final Live Culture for 2016. Please join me again in 2017. We close out today with The Clash.